Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Now back to Ringside with the voice of small business and the champion of the entrepreneur.
Say it now, gentlemen. Undisputed heavyweight champion of the world.
The Small Business Advocate, Jim Blasingame.
Welcome back. It's 34 after the hour. Thank you very much for joining me. Thanks for being part of my day. My pleasure to continue to be with you. As always, Ken Krosin is with us, folks. Kenneth Krosin, Kenneth E. Krosin, K-R-O-S-I-N, if you're Googling him. He is an attorney. He's an intellectual property attorney. He's a partner at Foley & Lardner. He's, of course, the thing he's the most proud of that I know he tells everybody about is that the fact that he's a longtime member of my Brain Trust. That's the big credential that I know he's so proud of. But what we're proud of is he's our good friend, Ken Krosin. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's good to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
Well, and I could tell you're excited, aren't you? Ken, what's new in the world of patents and trademarks? What are you seeing out there? Are we experiencing any kind of pressure, negative or help, positive, from the courts? Is there anything going on out there that we need to know about?
Well, I may have talked about this before on your show, Jim, but the courts in the last several years have really restricted patent owners' rights in a number of ways. One really interesting case that's sort of percolating up now is the Myriad case, which has gotten a lot of press. This is the one where the patent owner has patents on purified gene sequences.
Yeah.
And
what does that mean?
Well, in other words, your body has genes for all kinds of different things.
Right.
And over the years, the courts have said that you can actually get patents on purified gene sequences, gene sequences which you have isolated from human nature, from nature, and then purified in some way so that you can use them for various kinds of pharmaceutical applications.
So a biomedical process, is that would that be what it would be?
Well, it's more than the process. You actually get a patent on the gene, purified gene sequence itself.
But here's my question, though. You're not getting a patent on a new kind of gene. It's a gene sequence?
Well, the gene is a sequence of the DNA sequence in your
right.
body. So you might
right.
have the various building blocks for the DNA in the gene sequence.
I see what you're saying. Now, so are these new things that didn't exist before?
Well, the unpurified versions, of course, existed in the body. And by the way, just to clarify, a gene sequence really is, I'll call it a gene, just to make things simple.
Okay, all right, good, all right.
Genes have various components to them, and when they're in the body, they have things that are not useful in certain respects.
Right.
And so when you purify the gene sequence, you basically isolate it and then use it for various pharmaceutical applications.
So you turn an unpurified gene, as it's found in nature, into a purified gene, which makes it a tool.
Correct, and that's something that's been patentable for many years now. But
interesting,
the district court up in Boston in the Myriad case basically said no, that's not patentable subject matter because this is something that's found in nature.
Wow!
And
that was a paradigm shift, wasn't it?
Well, it really is a paradigm shift. The problem is that the court up there was sort of running contrary to many years of precedent
right.
of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit here in Washington.
Right.
And so now this has really become a very, very hot topic. The case involves, it's called the Myriad case because
mm-hmm.
the company involved.
But, so is the Supreme Court hearing this now?
Well, no, it's going to be going up to the Federal Circuit for hearing next. And
right.
Ultimately it might go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But this is just sort of an example of how the courts have tried to cut back on the patentability of various different kinds of products and processes.
Mm-hmm.
But over the previous 15, 20 years, the courts have sort of expanded patentability. Now the courts have cut back.
Why do you think? Is there a political trend? Is there a philosophical trend? Is there one or two individuals that are turning this tide? What's the reason?
Well, I think it's hard to really put your finger on. Except the only thing I can attribute it to, Jim, is that it's sort of the pendulum swinging back the other way. In other words, some people have thought that the courts have gone too far.
It's gotten out of hand.
Maybe gotten out of hand a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I think that the primary reason the Supreme Court has kind of taken the lead, saying, you know, let's sort of throttle back on what the U.S. Court of Appeals.
Very interesting.
The
now, court. When we come back, I want you to help us understand how that could possibly impact our small businesses, folks. These are things that, you know, if you're going to be a small business owner, you got to understand about how intellectual property works in the 21st century. Tony Taylor, right back with Ken Crozen. Stay with me. Little Joe Cocker bringing us back. Welcome back, 17 Till. It's Hitchcock Railway. I'm Jim Blasingame. Thanks very much for hanging out with us on our railway and on the Small Business Railway. And my website, by the way, is smallbusinessadvocate.com. I hope you check that out and use it to your advantage. Lots of stuff there that will help you with your small business. Don't forget to subscribe to my free newsletter when you get there. And, of course, if you're on Twitter, you can follow me there, at Jim Blasingame. Ken Crozen is our guest, K-R-O-S-I-N. Ken is Kenneth E. Crozen is intellectual property attorney with the Foley and Lardner Law Firm in Washington, D.C. Ken's a longtime member of our Brain Trust. We're talking about the patentability of things and primarily the way the courts are affecting kind of a sea change, Ken, it sounds to me like. About what's patentable, what's not patentable, and the reason I think this is important for small business owners to think about is there are a couple of things. Number one, their own inventions, their own innovations that they may be developing. Like, and I talked earlier before you got here, Ken, about the concept of business, a business method, a process, a method that would a business owner would be more likely to innovate rather than say. Inventing a brand new thing, that's one thing. The other thing is the courts could be restricting innovations that one day we could be using in our small businesses. What do you think?
Well, that's absolutely right, Jim. The problem is that if you cut back on the patentability and going back 25 years or so, the Supreme Court said that anything under the sun made by the hand of man is patentable. I mean, it just covered pretty much everything under the waterfront.
And that goes back how far?
Probably 25 years.
Yeah. Did that attitude kind of create the backlash that we're having right now?
I think that that's sort of the high water mark, and the pendulum has started swinging back because of I think some political pressure. And you know, the court changes, the makeup of the Supreme Court changes, the makeup of the Federal Circuit changes, and so you get people with different points of view. And you know, the law is an ever evolving thing. So as you get new justices on the Supreme Court who have views on what may or may not be patentable, they can change the way things work.
This is interesting. See, because when we think about the Supreme Court, if you're a strict constructionist like I am. Ken, and I don't know, you and I haven't ever talked about this. I don't know your position on this, but I believe the Constitution is something that should be, that doesn't need to be, that should be followed, not interpreted. And so I'm strict in that way, but that's when I think about things like, you know, not things that you patent, not inventions. The Supreme Court's involvement in that part of the marketplace, that's not really, I don't think of that as something the Constitution really has to do with that much. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but the patent statute derives directly from the U.S. Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 provides that Congress may enact laws granting patents to you know, inventors and copyrights to copyright law.
But it's not. But there aren't guidelines like there are in the original 10 articles, are there?
No guidelines whatsoever.
That's what I'm getting at. Is that's kind of where it stops, doesn't it? And so I guess I have not thought about how what kind of track a Supreme Court would take with regard to patents.
Well, you're right. I mean, and everything that there's the patent laws have been enacted by statutes by Congress. Same thing with the copyright laws, and those laws change almost every year. There's new new changes, additions to the laws, and the courts also come in and they lay their interpretation on top of those laws. So these rules that we live by in the intellectual property area are constantly changing. And when you get conservative judges, the laws tend to become more, and the application laws tend to become more conservative. So what I was saying before is that the pendulum is swinging back, I think, for a variety of reasons, which are cutting back on the rights of inventors.
You mentioned conservative judges. Are conservative judges more likely to be more lenient toward patents? And liberal courts more restrictive on patents?
Well, maybe I used the term inappropriately. What I really meant to say was conservative in the patent sense. In other words,
okay.
Conservative in saying that we don't think that certain things are patentable. We don't think that certain things deserve to be covered by patents. And one of the things that I was hoping to talk about today, Jim, was the Bilski case, which is going to be decided by the Supreme Court any day now.
Right.
And that goes to basically business method patents, which have been patentable for many years now.
Tell the audience what a business method is.
Well, a CMA account for Merrill Lynch, okay?
Right.
That is a method for banking, certain banking operations. That is a business method. There are all kinds of business methods.
For example, if I developed a method of managing customers, connecting with them, staying connected with them, computer programs around that and made that work at a push of a button and the entry of a little bit of information, I could possibly patent that.
That's correct. That's okay. A very good example.
And that's the kind of thing that a small business owner might come up with. I mean, right now, small business owners are coming up with systems for delivery methods to make sure that they save money on petroleum and energy and still serves their customers. That's a patent. That's a business method. I don't know if it's patentable or not, and that's what we're talking about.
Exactly. So the Bilski case is going to have an impact on that. We don't know which way the court is going to go, but I think the betting odds are that it's going to cut back on what is now patentable.
Interesting. Hold on to that thought. Ken Croson is our guest. We're going to be right back. We're going to talk about this some more after these messages. Stay with us. We're back at 7 till. I'm Jim Blasingame. Thanks very much for staying with me. Thanks for being part of my day. My pleasure to continue to be with you. Ken Croson is our guest. Ken is an intellectual property attorney. We used to call him patent attorneys. He does that too. But today it's so much more than just patents. It's so much more than just trademarks. It's an intellectual property attitude. And I encourage you, as you know, I've been doing this now since I've been on the air for over 12 years. Small business owners, you've got to develop an intellectual property strategy. You have to have a mindset, a thought process in your head about, okay, I'm not just in business here. I'm not just buying and selling things. I'm creating things that even if I don't want to patent them, I should be protecting them as trade secrets. Right, Ken?
That's right. Intellectual property is a incredibly valuable asset that people should think about protecting. And I've seen it over and over again where people haven't done that and they've lived to regret it.
I have done that. Our strategy around here is to err on the side of being, trying too hard to protect things, not being too late. Because I've been too late to the party before and somebody else, got what I had. And so I didn't like that. I didn't like that feeling. Ken, by the way, before we go any further, tell folks how we can find you online, your company, your firm.
All right. My law firm is Foley & Lardner, And it's www.foley.com.
Foley.com, one L.
F-O-L-E-Y. And my name is Ken, as you said, Ken Krosin, K-R-O-S-I-N. So I'm K-K-R-O-S-I-N at Foley.com.
All right, so check it out, folks. And I remind you, Ken's the guy who did the research that I told you about years before we knew him about how more and more companies, large and small, are leveraging intellectual property, intangible assets, more than tangible assets. Ken did the research on that, and it was watershed stuff as far as I'm concerned. Ken, come back to the courts. Let's talk about that a little bit more. You were saying that there's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now you thought was going to be decided. It should be any day now. And you think they're going to come down on the side of tightening the restrictions, tightening the applicability or the patentability of business methods?
Limiting patentability. And as I said before, this has really sort of been a trend for the last 10, 15 years, which as someone who's been in this business a long time, I find very troubling. I mean, people should be rewarded for their contributions. The patent system is designed to, of course, to encourage innovation. And if you don't have a patent system, if you don't credit people with these kinds of inventions, what happens is that it cuts back on the investment in those areas because you can't protect them. And if you can't protect them, then anybody can take them. And if anybody can take them, then mm-hmm. people are reluctant to invest. They're just not going to put money up.
Am I making a huge leap here, Ken, if I call this a form of redistribution of wealth?
You could call it that. I think that's a very appropriate terminology.
Because if I create something and I'm not able to protect it, then if it's valuable and I'm not able to protect it, then other people who didn't invent it at all can use it. And that's in my opinion, that's a variation of redistribution of wealth.
Well, you could call it that. You could call it stealing as well, I suppose.
Well, I was trying to be. You know me. I'm such a diplomat, Ken. You know me. Yeah. I'm always mincing words around here. But I like your term better. That's the reason we love Ken, folks. He cuts right to the chase. Ken, I got a minute left. What are some last thoughts on this topic?
Well, I guess the other thing is that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is under great stress now because they're way behind. They've got like 750,000 applications that are pending, and they just can't seem quite to get over the hump. So people that are coming up with these new inventions have them go to the patent office. They'll file up patent applications, and they'll just sit there, and there's a tremendous consternation. Everybody is trying to figure out what to do to get the pendency period down so that people can get their patents out.
But isn't in some cases having a patent pending better than actually getting the patent? If it's
I suppose it can have a what we call an in terrorem effect, scaring people away. But you don't really have any rights for the patent pending. It doesn't mean anything until you get your patent.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I understand. Hey, Ken. This has been really fascinating. Thank you so much for taking a sort of complicated topic and helping us make it simple and apply to our small businesses. You're the best at that, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, John. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Kenneth E. Krosin, ladies and gentlemen. He's going to be back. I promise he'll have more to tell us about as he continues to keep us updated on this very important topic. Folks, intellectual property is going to continue to be a bigger part of your world as a small business owner, so get used to it. Start learning more about it and thinking more about it, too. I got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, reminding you that a ship in the harbor is safe, but that's not what ships were made for.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.